Debate has raged for 20 years over a universal basic income or a basic income grant. It's from a humanitarian perspective, surely something that is an absolute necessity for some kind of support for the missing middle between those covered by child support grants on the bottom end and state pension support on the top end. And an issue that has only been heightened by the pandemic shock to the economy, pushing a further 4.5 million South Africans below the breadline. Now, there is some support for previously employed formal sector jobs as someone exits employment from UIF, but there isn't a generalized support for the unemployed, which of course stands at around 40% under the wide definition at the moment of the labor force and only set to increase. To debate this, I'm joined now by Professor Stephen Devereaux, who holds the SA-UK Bilateral Research Chair in Social Protection for Food Security and is affiliated to the Centre of Excellence in Food Security at the University of the Western Cape, and a well-known economist, Mike Schussler of economist.co.za. And we're hoping to be joined by Professor Alex van den Heerfer, who is Chair in the field of Social Security Systems Administration, a little bit later on. Professor Devereaux, perhaps you can just kick us off here, sketching the current model of social assistance in South Africa. It is well documented. Just set the scene here in terms of what is currently provided for in terms of social safety assistance for South Africans.
Thank you, Michael. South Africa has a fairly comprehensive social grants system. We have 7 social grants, the biggest of which is the child support grant, which reaches about 12 million children. That's about 2/3 of all children in South Africa. The second biggest grant is the older age pension, or the older persons grant, which reaches 3.6 million older persons over 60 at this point. And the third biggest is the disability grant, which reaches about 1 million people. So altogether, about 17 to 18 million people are directly covered by social grants. However, there is this huge gap, as you mentioned in your introduction, which is the missing middle, the 18 to 60 or 19 to 59 year olds who are not actually covered by social grants at all and have very little access to social insurance. And this is a problem, because if you think about social protection as a right, and it's in our constitution as a right, then we should have life cycle protection. You should be covered from birth to death. You should have adequate income for your basic needs and a life of dignity from cradle to grave. But this gap in the middle is a real challenge to that. We have a life cycle approach to our social protection, which actually doesn't reach that crucial middle-aged or working age population that don't have access to social insurance.
When it comes to, there's an additional element to grants as well, dependency. What are the numbers in terms of how many dependents are reliant on the various social grants in South Africa?
Yes, of course. The problem with our grant system is that it targets the non-working population, but a large number of poor people in South Africa are poor because they don't have access to anybody who's working. In other words, you get the child support grant because your parents aren't working or your caregiver isn't working. And in that case, the caregiver themselves or the adults themselves become dependent on the child support grant or their mother or grandmother's pension. And so the child support grant and the pension alone are probably supporting most of the unemployed population. A recent study done by UCT found, for example, that a large proportion of people in the informal sector, informal workers, are surviving at the moment on child support grants because they don't have access to any other source of income. So you could say that the grant system is indirectly subsidizing unemployment, which is not, of course, how it should be, because the child support grant is meant for the child. The older person's grant is meant for the older person. The fact that we don't have any support for the working age population is a huge gap in our social protection system, which is creating this dependency on the grants, which shouldn't be actually the case.
On that point, Mike, and broadly speaking here in economics, we see grant systems all over the world. The UK has a very well-known Dole system. It does tend to create some kind of dependency. From an economic perspective, what are the risks inherent in something like a basic income grant to the motivating drivers for individuals to go out there and seek employment, for example?
Well, if we look at the first grants that we had in South Africa when they started rolling out more seriously after 98, and we saw a big uptick in the early 2000s, we actually saw a decrease in self-employment in South Africa. If you look at the Stats SA surveys at the time, there was around 2.93 million people, adjusted for population now, that were self-employed. Now we've got that down at 1.3, 1.4 million, so there's a halving. And we were told that the social grants will help people become less dependent and it would create these economies. And I don't think that's quite the case. Or people are perhaps lying to get the social grant, I understand that. The other thing is, I think we must just put South Africa into perspective. We're an emerging market. In 2019, new World Bank data show that South Africa is now the 105th in line of GDP per capita. So I don't know if we really are a middle income market anymore. We're nudging our way into the poorer markets. For example, Sri Lanka is now richer than us and on a per capita basis. But in that context, if you go to the ILO, you will see that South Africa has, as a proportion of its population, the highest social coverage, which means that we give the most of our people, or a larger proportion, let's put it that way, of our people, a social grant in one form or another. The other factor that we must just keep in mind here, that as a percentage of spending on GDP, it might not sound much, but again, it is one of the highest in the world, in the emerging markets. So ultimately, that is what we have to also consider, because if we just make this thing bigger, it becomes more and more difficult to employ people because your taxes become larger. And if you look at South Africa, we've got 16.4 million people employed at the moment. We've got 18 million people on social grants. So we already have more people on social grants. If we then take the people that are unemployed in the broader unemployment sense, that's 10.8 million people. Forget the informal economy that might move over, but that means that you're going to sit with about 27, 28 million people on social grants and only 16 million people employed. And that is another dependency ratio that we don't want to afford.
Professor Alex van den Heerfer, who is Chair of Social Security Systems and Admin Studies at the University of Wits, joins us now. Welcome, Prof. Mike Schuster was just talking about the quantum in the South African context in terms of how many South Africans would be covered by a basic income grant and all the other grants at around 28 million, which is an eye-wateringly large number when you've got around 16 million taxpayers. Let's just talk about what is on the table now. What is the broad conception of a basic income grant that's currently being considered by government?
I don't think that a very clear proposal is on the table. I think that there's a general understanding of what a basic income grant is, which is that it is an unconditional, universally available grant paid to everybody on the basis of some general criteria such as citizenship or residency. And the fundamental idea behind it is that you're ensuring that there is an institutionalized form of income redistribution. So you can look at the overall quantum and the value of the grant, but in what it's really doing is restructuring consumption to a large extent within society. So that's what the current grants do, but a lot of the current grants are categorical in nature. They're very specific about what kind of support they're giving, and they're conditional, so they're means tested. So there's a limitation and an inefficiency associated with the means test, and that also creates poverty traps. It creates a lot of problematic incentives in order to qualify for those particular kinds of grants. And in many cases, the idea of a universal grant of any form doesn't take away the fact that they are still targeted. They are still targeted, even though they're unconditional. It's really about how you're structuring the financing for them, because you're still giving them back to high-income people and low-income people, but the higher-income people are actually paying for the grant, although they're receiving something back. But you're removing this requirement to assess eligibility in some sort of way. So if you look at it as being a institutionalized form of redistribution and a restructuring of consumption, you don't necessarily look at it as here is the overall cost of this, because it's going straight back into the economy, but it's restructuring consumption, it's restructuring aspects of how industry is organized.
And from that aspect, I know the Taylor Commission, Professor Devereaux, looked at both the macro and the microeconomic effects of that kind of redistribution in society and what impact that can have. What are the benefits, before we talk about how it might be funded, of this kind of approach to a more targeted universal income that has greater efficiencies in that it doesn't really have a means test and doesn't lead to some of those unintended consequences that we might see with a child support grant, for example, and individuals looking to claim the grant and thereby perhaps not really thinking about family planning the way that they should be? What are the benefits of a basic income grant?
Is it okay if I first respond on what Alex mentioned is the proposal on the table right now?
Sure.
Because I think it's really important. It's actually not a universal basic income grant that Minister Zulu proposed last week. What she's talking about is a targeted, almost an extension of the special COVID-19 social relief of distress grant. What she's saying is that we have realized through the COVID-19 lockdown that the unemployed and especially informal workers are seriously vulnerable to any kind of disruption to their livelihoods. And that's why this temporary grant of 350 Rand a month was introduced. But of course, that's going to end soon. And those people will remain without any social protection. And many more of them are going to be completely out of work now, 4 million or more probably. So what are we going to do about that? You know, do we accept that we as a society have a responsibility to those people that are going to be either displaced by COVID-19 lockdowns or are already unemployed or informally employed and therefore have no access to social protection? And if we accept that, and as I said earlier, there is a constitutional right to social assistance for all, then we have to find some way of providing assistance. And what Minister Zulu was talking about is a targeted, I would call it a basic unemployment grant, not a basic income grant, because it's not universal. So let's call it a bug rather than a pig. And if it's targeting the 18 to 59-year-old cohorts that are unemployed and unprotected, then it actually becomes affordable. We can start talking about affordability.
That raises another issue, Professor Van den Heever, to come back to you. That means it is means tested because you've got to be able to demonstrate that you're unemployed, surely, and that creates a layer of administrative difficulty.
So a lot of countries that have introduced, so let's say the language of basic income grant, when you use it, refers to what I indicated, which is a universal unconditional allocation. An unemployment social assistance allocation is conditional and is therefore not a basic income grant. So many countries do have that. So you will have your unemployment insurance, and what's been proposed in the past in South Africa is that there is the continuation aspect to unemployment insurance, but unemployment insurance is distinct from social assistance for unemployment. And many countries that offer it don't provide it on an unconditional basis. They do it on condition that you participate in labor activation programs, etc., so that it doesn't become because it's specifically related to unemployment, it can create all sorts of problematic incentives. As I said, the distinction with a basic income grant is it is purely unconditional. Nothing. There's no requirement to participate in a labor activation program. It presumes, through the way it's allocated, that it doesn't create a disincentive to employment because you will get the grant whether you're employed or not. So any employment merely tops it up. Mm. But an unemployment grant creates the issue that if the grant is very high, then you don't want to be employed. So in order to deal with that aspect, you have to design it very, very carefully.
I think, well, and this is going to be to everyone on the panel, I think there's no denying that the country finds itself on the horns of a dilemma here. We've seen the research from Nick Spall and others last week, 4.5 million South Africans pushed into poverty below the breadline thanks to COVID-19. On the other hand, we've got a shrinking tax base. Our debt to GDP is ballooning to well over 100% over the medium term expenditure framework. And the question remains, how will this kind of broad social assistance, be it a basic income or even a universal unemployment fund, be funded? Mike, let's start with you as the economist on the panel. Is there a way to fund this in the current environment?
It's going to be very, very difficult. South Africa has the highest tax to, or 10th highest tax to GDP level in the world, according to the UN Wider Universities Revenue Database. When I look further afield, I think we're also looking at If you look at funding, you've got to look at the interest rates. At the moment, South African interest rates for the month of May, and I know it's not a normal month, but they were 578 basis points above the average emerging markets rate, according to the Federal Bank, the Fed of St. Louis, who tracks these things. So our funding is already more expensive, for example, than Botswana and Nigeria, because of our big budget hole. So that is those two avenues are quite blocked. Yes, we spend one of the highest in the world on civil servant salaries, around 14.6% of GDP, with only Namibia, who we finance as well, higher than us in the emerging markets. So we've got to look at where we can get the funding from. And the problem is going to become increasingly that we have to look at the spending side as well. And the spending is going to be very, very difficult. You can talk about sort of the corruption and everything. The problem with that is that we're not getting on top of it. We haven't got on top of it. And we've got everybody screaming for more money. So if we go and look at everything, education as a percentage of GDP, our spending is quite high in emerging market terms. So if we look at a lot of these things, social elements, it's already very high. We're spending very little on infrastructure, so we can't cut there. Defense and policing is also quite low. So when I look across that, I can see salaries, I can see nice to haves, because let's face it, for an emerging market like South Africa, we may not need as many universities. We may need to relook the whole concept after COVID-19 of, you could study from home as you work from home. Those are the sort of elements that we may have to look at, because I cannot see taxes going higher. Our tax base is about, on pay as you earn, is about 7.5 million people, according to the SARS data. To put that into perspective, if you now all of a sudden got over 28 million, then it's for each personal income tax payer. I'm not talking about VAT or anything, because that's the biggest source of revenue that we have. We've got four dependents. And if you look at that situation, within that, there's also a large part of that is the people that get paid by the state, whether it's the civil servants or the agencies of government or the SOEs and so on. And that is the problem, that the private sector in South Africa is just literally too small. If you take total government revenue, including the water and lights and everything in South Africa, that government agencies, cross-border agencies and everything do, you get close to over 40% of GDP, which is very, very high for an emerging market, never mind just the tax part. So I don't know where we're going to get the money from.
And Professor Devereaux, has anyone done the sums on exactly how much we're looking at here for a grant that, as you say, will just be for those that find themselves without jobs? And where do you think the money might come from? SAA, perhaps?
That would be a start. Well, of course, the cost of any grant would depend on two variables. One is the number of people who qualify or are eligible for it, and the other is the amount of money that they get. So who gets it and how much do they get? And then you're looking at a wide range. So it very much depends on how narrow you define your eligibility. If you took, for example, 10 million, which is the expanded unemployed definition, then you add 10 million people to your social grants, and they'll go up from 17, 18 million to 27, 28 million. You've got to find money to pay for those 10 million extra grants. Then you could say, okay, let's start at 350 Rand, which is the social relief and distress grant at the moment. Let's pay that. So 10 million times 350 a month times 12 months would give you about 42 billion Rand a year. So you've got to find an extra 42 billion Rand. That's not cheap. It's a lot of money. But actually, we already spend close to 200 billion Rand on social grants, on the social grants system. So by filling that gap, you would need another 20%. You need to increase the budget by about 20%. Another point to recognize is that Minister Zulu made an interesting side comment when she announced the basic income grant was back on the table for discussion last week. She said that we could, if it's not considered affordable at first in full, we could start by targeting the youth and the 50 to 59 year old cohort. So if you were to take youth unemployment, and we know that's very high, it's over 50% probably, then you start with that group, and immediately the cost of this increased grant would probably halve, because you wouldn't be reaching 10 million people, you'd be reaching some maybe 4 or 5 million. So it very much depends on who is eligible, and also on how much you pay, and also if you adopt this idea of what we call progressive universalism, meaning that you start with what you can afford or what you think is politically feasible at this point, and you gradually expand it as the economy recovers and more resources become available.
42 billion rand, Professor van den Heerfer, in this environment where we just seem to be throwing billions around like candy, it doesn't actually seem like all that much. But in the broader scheme of things, for an emerging market that's debt to GDP levels are approaching 100% with our borrowing costs where Mike Schissler said they are, it does seem like this proposal won't find much support from Treasury. Where do you see the money coming from?
This kind of proposal should not be based on a kind of zero-sum calculation. It's got to have a positive-sum impact on GDP. That's really how you look at it. And it's quite risky if you upfront introduce a grant like this where you haven't actually considered the impact of moving forward with it immediately. So just throwing it into the system is one way to look at it. The other is that you look at incremental adjustments. So as Stephen indicated, a sort of a progressive approach. Now the Taylor Committee of Inquiry, it's important to note because I was on the Taylor Committee of Inquiry, recommended a process of incremental adjustments because there are an existing range of grants which can be adjusted in from universal. And when you start to look at adding components to those existing grants on an incremental basis, you're actually expanding. You're not truly introducing a basic income grant because they are still conditional, but you are expanding the redistributive aspect of the budget. So I think that what's important is that this kind of restructuring of income in South Africa is an important part of growing and developing the economy, but then it must be designed to do that. South Africa has one of the most unequal distributions of income and wealth in the world. And it's now well understood that that distribution of income and wealth actually constrains economic growth. So this should really be designed as part of a strategy that boosts growth, not is seen as a zero-sum game that puts growth at risk.
And boosts.
So that, and I think that we don't have the designs in place yet.
But boost growth by putting money in the hands of those consumers who won't save that money, but will rather go out and spend that money within the communities in which they live. And I think the Taylor Committee, which I just brushed on briefly overnight, it's a rather long report, over 300 pages, recommends that economic activity in that particular cohort really is spent in areas that generate labor absorptive growth. They're not high income, high value add imported items that the wealthy might spend on German luxury cars, although some of those are manufactured here. You get my point. Mike, what do you think of the idea of looking at this, as Alex says, as a way of actually stimulating growth, broadly speaking, if it's designed and targeted in the correct manner? Because
I've heard this stimulating growth story when we had the minimum wage introduced a year or so ago, and it didn't stimulate growth. In fact, we had one of the poorest growth periods of our lifetimes at 0.2%. And it's very difficult to put money into a system that's already efficiently constrained. So we have electricity constraints. And to say poor people don't buy imported things is also a little bit of a misdemeanor these days, because everybody has a cell phone. Everybody's going to be using electricity to charge that cell phone. People have a right to buy a heater, and they're probably made in China or wherever it may be, and clothes that are imported. So there will be leakages, and it doesn't all bode well for us. And as I said before, we were told back in the day, more than two decades ago, when this whole thing started with expanding the social grants, because South Africa's got 40 years of social grants, it was just always very good on the white side, very less poor, bad on the black side, if you wish. And I agree that we're unequal, but to think you can do that with social grants, I think is ridiculous. I think the problem is we need to create jobs, and that's what we need to do. And we need to focus on attracting business here and making it attractive for them. That means cutting taxes, things. That means putting the infrastructure in place for those businesses to operate. I think that's more important in my mind for equality going forward than is another social grant or grant type system. And to think it doesn't leak and doesn't create its own inefficiencies, I think we've been proved wrong time and again. The number of entrepreneurs has declined by half, and that's SA data. So,
Mike, on that point, I'm going to ask Professor Van den Heerfer just to respond in conclusion, because I see him shaking his head vigorously there.
You see, I agree with a lot of the basic issues, but I think that what we've only had a social assistance grant equivalent to 3.5% of GDP, which is quite it has a very limited impact. It doesn't really have an impact at scale on South Africa's distribution of consumption. See, what you want to do is, and this is where I agree fully, you do not introduce these kinds of redistributive strategies in isolation of industrial policy. And this is where we're failing in South Africa, is our tax policy, our industrial policy, and our social security policies are developed in complete isolation from each other. We do not have an unemployment strategy in South Africa tied to industrial policy. We do not have labor activation policies, and absolutely a minimum wage untied to a clear strategy where we have no other redistributive strategies in itself can have counterproductive effects. So the issue is that we're actually lacking a holistic approach on how we move forward. And that's why I'm emphasizing and agreeing we can't look in isolation at these strategies. Mm. They've got to be part of a deeper cut.
Professor Alex van den Heerfer, that's where we're going to have to leave it. Thanks to Professor Stephen Devereaux, who holds the SA-UK Bilateral Research Chair in Social Protection for Food Security at the University of the Western Cape. That was also Mike Schusse, economist at economist.co.za, and Professor Alex van den Heerfer, Chair in the field of Social Security Systems Administration and Management Studies, and also member of the Taylor Committee that looked into the basic income grant in the mid-2000s. Be sure to catch Business Day editor Lukanyo Mnyanda, who will explore these questions when he moderates a webinar titled Go Big or Go Home, a Crisis as Stimulus for a Real Change in Our Approach to Income Protection. The webinar is being presented by the Faculty of Commerce, Law and Management at WITS. It's also being hosted by Business Day and the Labour Research Service. And the speakers at the free event are Professor Murray Leybrandt, Director of the Southern Africa Labour and Development Research Unit at the University of Cape Town, Lebo Mulausi, who is Social Development Coordinator at the Congress of SA Trade Unions, and Brenton Van Freda, who's Deputy General in the Department of Social Development. For the details, you can go onto the Business Day website. That's tonight at 6. Go on and register for a free event as the basic income becomes the hot talking point into the second half.